Welcome to Inside the Castle, the podcast that goes behind castle doors to have real conversations with real people about solving the nation's toughest challenges.
I'm one of your hosts today, Aaron Snyder.
And I'm Angie Fryermuth.
Today we are wrapping up the last part of our three-part series celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Corps Civil Works. In our first episode, we discussed the origin of the Corps from 1802 to 1824, and in the second, we discussed the early Corps from 1824 to 1865. Today, we're going to take a big leap. In this third and final episode, we're going to be talking about the Corps from 1865 to today, a period of about 160 years. With us to talk about this is Jonah B. Taylor, the Corps History Office, who will share with us how the Civil Works mission has evolved since the Civil War. Jonah, thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Aaron and Angie. I could do just a little brief recap of some of the things we talked about before, but this year marks the 200th anniversary of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Civil Works Program, and we're commemorating these two key pieces of legislation, which were a month apart, the General Survey Act, which looked at internal improvements, roads and canals, which was passed in April, and then the first Rivers and Harbors Act for improvements to the Mississippi and Ohio River, which was May 1824.
Thanks, Jonah. It's great to have you back. I wanted to talk about, obviously a lot has happened since the Civil War. So you're going back to 1865, and the nation is growing significantly with a lot of westward expansion. Kind of want to talk a little bit about how did the geographic area of USAF's mission changed with the size of the nation. It seems like they're integrated and integral at this part. We're expanding west. You need infrastructure. The Corps is a critical part of that. Could you talk a little bit about that expansion and how the Corps kind of moved west as the nation grew?
Yeah, so that's a great point. I think you have to remember that in 1824, the state furthest west was Missouri. And beyond that was an organized territory. And the biggest challenge was moving raw materials and crops from west to east. So the General Survey Act really focused on roads and canals. But as the 19th century goes on and we bring in these new territories and we organize them into states, it's really a new technology, which was the railroad, that gained momentum. And this canal craze that really... so-called canal craze that was what the General Survey Act sent out Army engineers and then topographic engineers to really survey for, that really ends by the 1840s. But the Corps of Engineers navigation work, which grew from the first Rivers and Harbors Act, which was about primarily removing sandbars and snags on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, that navigation work was still critical because most goods and people continued to move by water for at least part of their journey, even as the railroad network expands west in the 19th century. So as new territories are settled in what would today be the Midwest, but at that time was the Northwest territories and states, Congress turned to the Corps to better develop harbors on the Great Lakes, where all these new settlements and small towns have been competing for the best facilities for Great Lakes shipping. Basically, everybody started competing with Chicago as the 19th century goes on, because Chicago was that nexus between the lakes and the railroad network. And the Corps of Engineers worked to connect the Great Lakes to one another. I mean, of course, one of the examples of that are the Sioux Locks there at Sault Ste. Marie. And also, how do we connect the Great Lakes to other major waterways, such as the Ohio and Mississippi River? How do you get from Chicago to the Mississippi? That's one of the key things the Corps of Engineers was doing as the 19th century goes on. We had an Office of Western River Improvements, and that office focused on that kind of maintaining navigation, again, clearing snags, dangers to navigation on the Mississippi and Ohio and tributaries. But overall, you see this movement of the Civil Works Program along with the nation into the Midwest and then beyond the Mississippi River. And that's how our program expanded.
So I've always knew that, the Corps of Engineers started off in navigation and helping make sure that we could transport goods and services across the nation. When did we start to broaden beyond navigation?
That's a great point, because of course we do a lot more than navigation. Well, navigation really dominated the 19th century until after the Civil War. So, you know, let's begin with the other big civil works mission that you see in the late 19th century and especially into the early 20th century, and that's flood control. In the late 19th century, there were some Corps of Engineers flood control projects, such as here in Washington, D.C., with the Potomac River and the Southwest Waterfront and West Potomac Park, you know, creating a, you know, making sure that that channel was clear. That was a flood control project, but it was sort of sold to Congress as a navigation project. It was justified in those terms. But what we were really doing by building the tidal basin and reclaiming land of the Potomac was trying to protect the city from flooding. But that, again, was not an official mission of the Corps of Engineers. So when you get to the early 20th century, as areas along rivers were more densely settled and farmed, and there were some truly catastrophic floods that basically Congress couldn't ignore. And by the way, overall, the population of the United States had doubled from about 36 million to more than 70 million in those last 30 years of the 19th century. So we have an overall population, 70 million by 1900. And because of these floods in more populated areas, there was a series of flood control acts. First, 1917, you know, looking specifically at the Sacramento River and again at the Ohio and Mississippi. There was a flood control act in 1928, which was the Mississippi River and Tributaries Project, the start of that after the absolutely unprecedented catastrophic flood of 1927. And then finally, by the time you get to 1936, we get a national flood control missions for the Corps of Engineers. The Flood Control Act 1936 gives us that role across the country. So it moved, you know, from certain regions to the whole nation by the early 20th century. And, you know, if you want to look at some other areas that we started to get into, at the same time as there's this increasing need for flood control, there's this huge interest in electrification and developing hydropower. So the Corps of Engineers completed the first federal hydropower project at Wilson Dam on the Tennessee River in 1926. But that had really been a legacy of the needs for ammunition production of World War I. It just took until after the war was finished to build that structure. But in 1927, Congress asked the Corps to study every major river basin for hydropower potential. So over the next decade, the Corps completed most of these studies and said at the time that most of those rivers weren't really worth the national investment. I think these were called the 308 reports, and I think out of 127 of them, only 16 were favorable. But basically, the genie was out of the bottle. Private companies had already begun developing dams for hydropower all over the country. And in the West, you have this new Bureau of Reclamation that was sort of busy doing the same thing, combining water supply, flood control, and hydropower. So the Corps had to get into the hydropower business as well. So you put those two things together, flood control and hydropower, and you begin to get closer to what we call multipurpose planning by the time of the New Deal era in the late 1930s. And, you know, I could keep going this way, but essentially for the next 40 years, so the late 1930s to the 70s, it's the era of big dams, large multipurpose projects that changed the landscape of so many states and how the public came to know the Corps of Engineers, or a lot of the public, through our lake projects. But that's that era of big dams, 40 years, 1930s to 1970s, and by the mid-1970s, environmental concerns, reduced federal budgets kind of bring an end to that era. And then, you know, we're sort of in the environmental era where you see the impact of the Clean Water Act, the rise of regulatory programs, cost sharing, ecosystem restoration. And of course, we're left with this large operation and maintenance program from the legacy infrastructure of the big dam era. Yeah, that's speeding really quickly through time and a lot of complex stuff, but I hope that it gives an example of how these missions move beyond navigation into a lot of the areas that we're more involved with today.
You know, I think that's helpful. And there's been a few things in listening to you talk that I never thought I'd either hear or say is like railroad as a new technology. And I'm kind of like, man, in 150 years, is someone going to be looking back and be like, hey, that AI was a new technology? It's kind of crazy to think about some of these things. Yeah. And even the discussion about the size of the country, you know, in 1900, you had 70 million people expanding. And with the core, I know, like, you know, we talked a lot about flood, nav, hydropower, and then moving into ecosystem restoration. Kind of curious, I know that the core, at least from my district in St. Paul, I've always heard little random bits of trivia that the core has worked on some of these random things that are super cool, like St. Paul District, supposedly, you can correct me here, was the entity that built the roads in Yellowstone. So that's why we have those roads, was from St. Paul District. Wondering if from a history perspective, are there other unique aspects or big recognizable features that you could call out that the core has supported? I think you mentioned Sioux Locks is a big one, but there are other unique aspects that the core contributed to over time.
Gosh, yeah, there's so many large scale, interesting projects. You know, this is not necessarily like the Yellowstone roads, which you're right, Army engineers definitely did that. And I don't know if it was St. Paul District, but it totally could have been. That's interesting. I think the thing that comes to mind is the sort of journey of the Mississippi River and tributaries project. And I know that's, rather than being like a specific site, I mean, you could pull some of those out, like the old river control structure or something like that. But, you know, you go from a program in the early 20th century that was mostly levees, and that doesn't really work so well because it gets overwhelmed in 1927, to this very sophisticated management of the river with floodways. And that keeps getting built out, you know, in dribbles and drabs as it gets funded throughout the 20th century. But this dedication to managing the river for these multiple purposes all the way to 2011, when you know, the system really gets tested by a major flood and all the floodways are used. And that's just remarkable. Remarkable commitment, you know, to a particular basin by the core, and a remarkable, not just a set of infrastructure that allows that system to be operated safely, but also, you know, just the planning and the kind of the project management ability, you know, across that much territory to see something like that be built and operated. It's remarkable.
Yeah, that's a great point, I think.
And I don't think exists in many other countries either. I mean, I don't think a system that large you see in other major river basins to the same extent.
Yeah, I find it interesting, you know, looking at that, thinking like, we see what's there today, but the reality is that was built up over time with many iterations. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just all of a sudden a 9-foot channel. That wasn't the starting point. I don't know what if that starting point was, a 4-foot channel, a 4.5-foot channel, but it developed over time and continuously got built up to what we have today. So we really are living on the foundations, you know, that were planted, you know, maybe a couple hundred years ago, which is pretty exciting to think about in the big picture.
Exactly.
So I know in our previous episodes, we talked a little bit about the role of the federal government. I think we talked a little bit about some challenges, maybe even between like the federal government and state rights and who's doing projects and infrastructure. Post-Civil War, did the role of the Corps or the role of the federal government in civil works keep coming up as an issue, or was that kind of settled in the earlier years?
So you're right. 200 years ago, there were these significant constitutional questions about whether or not the federal government had a role in paying for internal improvements and infrastructure that might benefit one region more than another, because states were competing with each other before that. And sure enough, those same questions came up as the Corps tried to move beyond navigation into other missions. You know, could the federal government pay for flood control that had no connection with interstate commerce? Because like I said, here on the Potomac, you know, we tried to do a flood control project in the name of keeping the Washington Channel open for commerce. but it was really a flood control project. So if we were actually just going to say this is going to be for flood control only, or you know, flood control and other purposes, but flood control primarily, can the federal government have that role? And in that case, you know, flood control really meant levees, which were also part of improving navigation on the Mississippi as well, maintaining the channel. So it gets a little complicated, the relationship. But certainly that constitutional question was asked in Congress in the early 20th century in 1917 with that first Regional Flood Control Act. And I think in general, the voices were not as loud because some of that had been answered. And it's also, I think, because the federal government itself had grown so much since the time of the General Survey Act. So, you know, you think it's about 100 years between the General Survey Act and the 1917 Flood Control Act. And already, you know, by the First World War, 1917 as well, for the American entry into the First World War, we're used to a larger, more bureaucratic government that managed, you know, these really sort of demanding and complex affairs of a nation that was a world power at that point. And so I just think you can see that in the congressional debates, but it's not as much a point of a contention, but it certainly gets asked. Yeah, by the way, I just could add something else. So when you get into the 20th century, it's not, you know, does the federal government have a role in doing civil works, you know, that benefit more, you know, that could benefit one state more than another. But, you know, should the civil works program of the Corps of Engineers stay with the Army or move to a civilian agency? Because, you know, we have a much stronger and larger Department of the Interior. We have this Bureau of Reclamation. Why not take that civil works mission away from the Army? And so we've had to make the case for this unique role of the Army in civil works, which is unique in the world. We've had to make that case several times since the 1920s. And 200 years ago, in 1824, there just wasn't much of a question because the government was so much smaller and we didn't have these institutions. Army engineers were the vast majority of trained engineers in the country, and the Army was the only government asset that could undertake surveying and mapping and making waterways safer. So that question doesn't come up as much. Who should do the work?
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like that's one of the most common questions we get, you know, when you go to a public meeting, is like, you say we're Army Corps of Engineers and like, why the Army? You know, so it's I've never really had an answer to that, but it makes a lot of sense hearing that. Well, that's because when we started, that was the government entity that was capable of delivering a large program at the time.
Right.
So it's an interesting history.
Right. We trained the engineers. That's where the knowledge of civil engineering was with Army engineers.
I think we're nearing almost the end of our series here. Before we go, Jonah, is there anything else that you would like to add?
Just sort of building on that last point. I've been thinking about this since we started writing about the General Survey Act and learning more about it. If I had one takeaway from looking at this history, it's really that 1824 was the beginning of the idea that a civil works project in a specific region or a specific state could actually benefit the nation as a whole. That basic concept was just not as well understood 200 years ago because people's identities were with their states. And there was an idea that, you know, any infrastructure in one state would help that area win over another. And so there was just a lot of concern about federal investment benefiting one state over another. You know, before that Supreme Court case that my colleagues talked about, Gibbon versus Ogden, you know, you have one state granting its own monopoly to a steamship line or a canal company, and that was all just blown away. So today, you know, fast forward 200 years, I think it's pretty clear that the work we do locally ultimately benefits the entire country.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't agree more. It seems like everything's so interconnected and benefits each other. But Jonah, thank you for joining us today for this edition of Inside the Castle. We appreciate you and your insights. Until next time, be safe, be innovative, and remember your history.
Thanks for joining us for this Inside the Castle podcast. To provide your feedback, email us at cw.infrastructure.team@usace.army.mil. Stay tuned for additional Inside the Castle podcasts as we explore life inside the core and revolutionize civil works together.